Good morning, everybody. Happy holidays. Four Mormons came over as usual on Friday. They stayed 2 hours this week. And my young friend Wayne, who's 19, decided to go through Romans 3 with them, and they liked that. And this is every 6 weeks the Mormons rotate their missionaries. Some of them they're called your missionary partner is called your companion. That's what they're called. So we discussed that whole idea of rotating because they have to say goodbye to the companion, and then next Friday that means I'll have some new faces. I'll have some old faces and new faces. These guys are now, they all know me well, so they always relax and unwind, and pretty soon I can see them as real people, and they're just really, they're very, very nice guys. They're polite, and they've got great family values, and they really would like to learn more about the New Testament because it's part of their books. And anyhow, you're supposed to all have Mormon friends visiting you if you're home. It's very easy, and just be patient and don't argue the Book of Mormon and just be friends with them, and they're really neat. Anyway, that's enough of that. I got excited yesterday and ran off some copies, some photocopies for you. Number one is the revised class schedule for the rest of Job. And then one of the commentaries I like on Job very much is by a man named Francis Anderson, who's from Australia, and I really liked his introduction to the last part of Job so much that I copied that for you, stole it out of his book. I think it's a very good summary. As we're just ready, if you have suffered with Job all through his misery, we're really at the good news part now, and it's suddenly going to get really very, very fascinating. In fact, next week I've asked Reverend Dr. Thompson if he would please read. He has a doctor, a friendship doctor, PhD. I've asked him if he would please come up and read this great last poetic section when God addresses Job directly. So that ought to get you in a good mood for the holidays and maybe humble. The other piece of paper I put down here, since we're at a transition in Job, I wrote down in very tiny little font, because it wouldn't fit on one page otherwise, a few of the themes in the book of Job. Job does not address all forms of suffering. The book of Job doesn't. It only addresses one kind of suffering that happens to a righteous man. So I thought for the very last class in the series, we ought to maybe briefly touch on other kinds of suffering. Because there's plenty of suffering in the world, and not all suffering is addressed by the book of Job. As you've been following Job, you know that one of the major issues is how does a man become righteous in the sight of God? That's one of the themes in here. Why do righteous people that God finds righteous, why do they suffer at all? Well, we're going to find out a lot about that in Job. Why do bad things happen to people who God declares are righteous and whom he's pleased with? Why should anything bad happen? Why does God sometimes not answer our prayers, even when we're desperate and we need an immediate answer? Why is he silent a lot of the time? That comes in here. Why is God so slow in punishing evil sometimes? Why does he appear to ignore the obvious evil in the world? And maybe he doesn't even punish evil at all. Maybe he's detached and uninvolved. That's some of the things. You have a case of things that you believe, how would you go to take God to court? How do you subpoena God and ask him in the court to please defend himself? And that's a little presumptuous, isn't it, to do that if God's the judge? But that's in here. One of the pressing questions in the whole book of Job is, there a mediator between God and man? That Job brings that up, and his friend, young friend Elihu brings that up, and both of them have a vague idea that there probably is a mediator. There probably is a vindicator. That at the end, the righteous people probably are vindicated before God. They're not clear about it. And there are some hints here that Job expects us to be raised from the dead and to stand before God as a whole and complete person. Where is wisdom to be found in a world where there's plenty of knowledge? How do you find wisdom? There's an awful lot of wordiness coming out of Job's three friends, and none of it is helpful to Job. You remember that Job's three friends came to comfort him, quote-unquote, and to encourage him. And when they saw the pathetic sight of poor Job with boils and painful, ugly sores sitting in a heap of ashes with his whole property destroyed and his seven sons and all wiped out and his whole estate reduced to nothing, and they were shocked and horrified, and immediately they jumped to the conclusion that God, that Job had sinned, all of them did, and so they now they rail against him repeatedly and wear him out by accusing him of sin over and over again. All three of them gang up on him. There's not much comfort in that. They don't pray for him. They don't encourage him at all like they intended to do. Is God arbitrary? Why would God allow all this? Well, in the beginning of the book of Job, we had this strange little section of God meeting with the angels in heaven behind the scenes, and Satan appears there, and God brings up the issue of Job. And God asks Satan, "Have you looked at Job? He's a righteous guy." And Satan says, "Oh, no, he's not. If you test him a little bit and challenge him a little bit, he'll curse you." And so God turns the devil loose on poor Job, and the first of terrible disasters fall on him, and Job ends up saying, "The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." So that first test fails, and the second time Satan says, "You know, men will curse you if you just give them bad health and make them feel miserable." And so God turns the devil loose a second time, and he gets to go and torment Job down to the very limits of not ending his life. Therefore, Satan is an agent of God. Satan works only by permission, and Satan always works within limits. But just barely, Job is allowed to live. And that seems, why in the world would God do that? Does God just go around having little wagers with the devil back and forth, and they have a little betting contest, and God bets that Job won't curse him, and Satan says, "I bet the other way, and who's going to win this little wager?" Is that what God's like? Well, it seems like that from the beginning of the book, but it really isn't. As we've seen, the worst of Job's tests come from his friends, quote, friends, all of whom are not very helpful. And you can see that they've already made up their minds about Job and about the world, and they are self-righteous and pharisaical in the end. And last week we went through the four speeches and five chapters of a young man named Elihu. He's very young, who has waited until all these older men stop talking. And he's brash and impetuous, but he does have a heart for God, and he does seem to have really good insights. And he comes right out and says, "Job, you're really not righteous after all." And we talked a little bit about self-righteousness, about feeling that you're righteous before God, and how easy it is for us to be self-righteous and think that our track record, our lifestyle has made us acceptable in the eyes of God. God owes us. And true righteousness, as we talked about, is a gift from God. It's imputed to us as we have faith in Jesus. Well, Job is truly righteous. He has really believed in God at some point in the past. So as far as God's concerned, Job is a righteous man. But also, we've seen it's pretty clear by now that Job is also self-righteous. And Elihu is a little bit concerned that maybe Job really will curse God, in which case Satan would win the bet. And he's also concerned that Job might even be making himself better than God or higher than God. And he's a little concerned that his friend Job might step over the limits. And as we were reading through those discussion. So Elihu doesn't have all the answers, but he does have some good insights, and he doesn't get Job to change his mind. But towards the end of his speeches, it seems like a great thunderstorm is coming up over the plain, and lots of thunder and lightning, Midwestern thunder and lightning, and a great display of God's grandeur in the heavens. And Elihu then runs off onto a long discussion of how great and mighty and awesome God is. And so Elihu has a belief that God will eventually answer the questions of Job. And we had that little discourse from Elihu, the young man. Now, to read ahead a little bit, we'll find out that God is very, very unhappy with Job's three friends. And he's not unhappy with all the things that Job has said. And God has nothing to say about Elihu. So we have to say that Elihu has got a clean record, maybe a little naive and brash, but and he does have some good insights, but God's not mad at him, and God's not mad at Job. And now we're going to hear from God. Ray Stedman's notes are available, and here's Ray's introduction to chapter 38 from Ray Stedman. All through the Bible, the only man or woman who ever receives anything from God is the one who comes with a humble and contrite heart. If you think you have something to offer him, or that you have accomplished achievements that no one else can equal, you cut yourself off from the wisdom and knowledge of God. But the man who is humble and contrite, waiting upon God, asking him to teach him, will find that God will lift him up in grace and power and glory. That is what is about to happen to Job. The very next voice we hear, as chapter 38 opens, will be the voice of God himself speaking directly to Job. The next few chapters are God speaking directly to Job. And next week I've asked a reverend doctor, PhD, Dr. Friendship, Bob Thompson, if he would please read this great poetic section so that you have it all in your mind for the Christmas holidays and you can meditate on it and think about it. It's one of the grandest, most beautiful and eloquent examples of Hebrew poetry we have anywhere in the Bible, and this is God himself speaking. So it would be well if we listened to it. I'll start on it today, and then we'll have Bob read it next week, and then after the first of the year, we'll go through it a little bit. Now, this is rather interesting when God speaks. God does not address Job's two basic questions. The two basic questions that Job has are, I want a list of charges against me, God. If you have something against me that's caused all this to come upon me, would you please tell me what the charges are in court? I want to go to court with you, and I'd be happy if you'd list the things that you've got against me. Well, God says nothing about that. Nothing. Job would also like to have a certificate of righteousness. He'd like to have a merit badge that says, you really are righteous. You've been saying that you're righteous all along, and you really are, and here's your diploma. You are righteous. God doesn't answer that at all. So here's God listening to all this conversation going on with Job's friends and with Job and listening to the whole thing. And when God speaks, he just ignores all that conversation. He just totally ignores it. And he says what he wants to say. Now, the reason I gave you this little quote from Anderson is that if you look at this, you could think that God was rebuking Job or chewing him out or lecturing him or thundering down in judgment at him. And I don't really think that's what's going on here. I really don't think so. And Anderson doesn't think so. I think that it's a very wonderful privilege to have the Creator, the God of the universe, take you on a little guided tour. You go up to this great big estate and this magnificent garden, and the owner of the estate comes down and gives you a personal tour through the garden and shows you around the whole estate and explains everything to you in great detail. What a treat that would be for us poor people that don't have nice estates. Job has been clamoring for wisdom, and here he gets taken into the school of wisdom, of God's wisdom, and he has the master teacher give him some lessons in wisdom. Wisdom is the most precious thing we could all ask for. Now, we know from the New Testament that Christ is the wisdom of God. The wisdom literature, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Job, is well known among the rabbis in the Old Testament as insights into wisdom. Now, another little interesting clue here is that when God is speaking, generally, which person of the Trinity does the speaking? Usually the Word of God, usually Jesus the Word. So how would you like to have Jesus come down and take you by the hand and walk you through the universe and ask you a series of rhetorical questions? This is a good teaching style. When somebody comes to you with questions, ask them another question. Then that makes them think and draws them out. This is not an attack on Job at all. It's not. It's a absolutely glorious, wonderful answer to all of his suffering, and well worth studying. We're in a scientific age, and one of the problems with, say, scientific naturalism now is that we have the disappearing God of the gaps. We've explained away God. We don't need God because we now understand nuclear physics and DNA and all the things. There's no room for God anywhere in the universe, so we don't have to believe in God anymore. That's the academic theory that prevails. Naturalism. Everything can be explained on the basis of the physical material world. Yes, the teaching style of Jesus in the Gospels is very frequently rhetorical. Somebody will ask him a question, and he asks a counter question that resolves the issue more eloquently, more beautifully than a direct answer would be. Makes you think. That's the idea here. Now, verse 1 of chapter 38. The Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind. And now, for the first time all the way since the very first part of the book, we have the covenant name of God, Yahweh. The covenant name of God. It's from the verb to be, I am who I am, is speaking. And this is always the personal name. When you have a personal relationship with God, it's Yahweh. Genesis chapter 1 is Elohim. Genesis chapter 2 is Yahweh Elohim. Personal covenant name. We have, in these long chapters of discussion, we have the name Eloah 41 times. That's dual, two persons. And we have Shaddai some 38 times. Shaddai is God all-sufficient, and we have Eloah. So all of the dialogues that have been going on have been Eloah and Shaddai. That's sort of God is great, and God is all-sufficient, and God is mighty, and God's great. And now when God speaks, he speaks as Yahweh. This is the personal God who introduces himself. And this is the mediator we've all been waiting for. This is the mediator, the man who understands this. Okay? And he says of Job in verse 2, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? That sounds like a rebuke. What do you think? There's my rhetorical question of the day. What do you think of that opening verse from God who says to Job? God's not talking to anybody but Job. He ignores everybody else here. Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? That sounds like there's a scowl on the Lord's face, and he's, who do you think you are, kid? You're just a nobody. I don't think it's that. I don't think it's a rebuke. Anybody like to guess an opinion on that? Talking about his friends. Okay, yes, we've had plenty of dark counsel from the friends. Yes, plenty of bad advice from the friends. All of whom claim to be representing God. Is it a bad thing to misrepresent God? Oh, it's very bad. Romans 16, remember, Paul's closing advice is, be careful not to speak beyond your own experience. You know, don't presume upon God's grace. Don't presume to be speaking for God if you don't know from experience what you're talking about. And Job's friends are not looking very good, so they've certainly darkened wisdom without knowledge, yes. Has Job done that? Well, yes. Job's supposed to be the senior guy. He's supposed to be the source of wisdom and truth and light for the younger generation like Dan and others, Benjamin Elihu, and others. And here's the senior spokesman, and he's obviously really upset and perturbed and seems to have lost his faith. So God is saying to Job, you don't have the whole picture. You really don't know who I am. Do you really know all about God that there is to know? Will you ever know all about God that there is to know? Absolutely you won't. Will there always be mystery and wonder and awe in who God is, all on into eternity forever and ever? Can you have an exhausting knowledge of God? Absolutely not. Can you have little glimpses of God that are real? Yes, indeed you can. Can you go talk to others and find that their experience with God is genuine? Absolutely. Can you misrepresent God if you state your opinion on something and you presume to be speaking for God and you're wrong? Oh, that's real easy. Real easy to give an off the top of your head opinion. And we really don't know one another's hearts and motives, and so it's real easy for us to be judgmental towards others. I do it all the time. It's just bad. All right. Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? You don't have all the facts, Job. Let me give you a bigger picture. Let's get out of your little pity party. Let's get out of your little narrow world and your little bit of suffering, and let's go on a little tour of the universe. That's how God deals with this whole situation. You don't have a big enough God. Some years ago, J.B. Phillips wrote that wonderful little book, Your God is Too Small. Still a great book to read. Your God is too small. You haven't got a big enough God to handle your problem. That's the idea. So here's God. He says in verse 2, prepare yourself like a man, or gird up your loins, right? And I'll question you. And you answer me. We're going to have a little one-on-one discussion, and I'm going to ask you a series of questions, and I'd like you to please answer them if you would, please. You seem to know a lot. Your friends think they know a lot, too. So let's do a little Q&A time. This is not the final exam, by the way. This is midterm. So, Creator 101. It is. And I am on several little networks with creationists, with biblical creationists, and they are, in general, a bunch of real losers. They're all stuck in 1920, and they don't seem to have read their Bible very well, and I don't think most of them have ever read Job. They've got all these opinions of how God created the universe, and if you argue with the how God created the universe, they get mad at you. You can have your idea of how God created the universe and know Genesis 1 really, really well, and then when you come to Job, you'll see, well, I don't know so much after all. Okay? Verse 4. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Where were you? There was a time when there was no universe at all, and I created a whole universe. And he uses the idea here that Job can understand, the idea of building a building or building a house. That's the analogy of laying the foundations. And in Hebrew, here carries the idea that you're going to build a building. You start with a good foundation, and you dig the trenches on the right piece of land, and you put in the footings, and you make sure that the building has got a solid base under it. That's the idea. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Of course, the earth is a sphere, and you don't ordinarily think in scientific terms of the earth as having foundations, but this accommodates our way of liking to see structure in things. God's saying, here's this, we now know is a sphere, and Job knew it was a sphere, but I laid the foundations for the earth, I wish you'd been there, and you could have written it down in your diary at the time and described it or painted a picture of it, but you weren't there, were you? Tell me if you have understanding. You haven't even read about it. Then he says in verse 5, who determined its measurements? A good surveyor. Surveyor surveys the property. A good architect who makes the building plans. They get approved by the council, the city council, or the county, whoever it does that approves your plan. And it's an exacting job for the architect to design a building and get it earthquake-proof and fireproof and sound and livable and well-heated and environmentally friendly and all that sort of stuff. And so God is the designer and the architect and the builder, and he does everything according to the building codes. In fact, he's the one that wrote the building codes, apparently, partly. Who stretched out the line upon it? That's the surveyor's line or the tape measure. Yeah. This is the, in the science, we have today what's called the cosmic anthropic principle, and it's this discovery by secular cosmologists that the universe appears to be fine-tuned for man. It appears, these are non-Christians writing, it appears that the universe was designed with man in mind because the earth is exactly the right distance from the sun. If you moved the earth a little bit, it would either be too hot or too cold. If you changed little tiny parameters in the universe, we wouldn't have oxygen. We wouldn't support life. The whole universe is finely tuned. How did this happen? How did evolution bring that about? That's the It's a huge question, and it's now generally recognized that the universe is man-shaped, kind of. It's kind of as if there was a human being involved in its design. There's one very, very arrogant physicist named Tipler who wrote a book about evolution, and he says that we are evolving, of course, and we're now beginning to take charge of our evolution. So we're in control of our evolution, so let's evolve and gain knowledge and understanding, and then one day we'll be able to be God, and once we get to be God, we can step out of time and go back and create the whole universe in the first place. How's that for a reputable scientist telling us where we came from? We created ourselves. Or we will soon, as soon as we get the last few details figured out. He's never read Job. What happens if you're run over by a bus? That's right. So look at the humor in God. Look at what a wonderful sense of humor he has, how delightful he is. And just look at this hands-on creation. This isn't a universe ordered from a Sears Roebuck catalog. It isn't a universe that God said, oh, I'd like to have a universe as one of my toys. And so he places the order, and then God checks out the universe, and then he says, I'm going on a long vacation. We don't have that here. We have a hands-on creation where God's the creator, and lavish detail. Every single thing is lavishly, carefully, meticulously created, atomic level or cosmic level. And then after it's all created, God stays around to make sure it's managed right and that it runs right and that it's adjusted. And he's very involved in all of the day-to-day things that go on, as we've seen already. Who determined its measurements? We know now from science that the universe has a finite number of molecules. Forget what that is, the 10 to the 80th or something. We know that there's a limit, upper limit to the number of molecules in the universe. There's an upper limit to the age of the universe in seconds. I forget that number, 14, 15 billion years maximum. And there's so the universe we live in is finite, as we see it now, the material world, and it has a finite lifetime because it's running down, and so science agrees with that with the Bible on that regard. Now, when we get to heaven, I think we'll find out that this isn't the only world, that there are worlds beyond worlds beyond worlds. So if you get tired of exploring our cosmos and with its billions of galaxies, if you get tired of that, there'll probably be another world beyond that for us to go see, if you're qualified. And if you want to do space travel, boldly going where no man or woman or child has ever gone before. Verse 6, to what were its foundations fastened? That's really neat. If you think about it, empty space, and you're going to create a universe, what are you going to anchor it to? Sky hooks? You're going to use sky hooks? Are you going to put anchors out? Anchors out into emptiness. See the humor in all that, because we think that we're anchored to terra firma. So we have an earthquake, we think so. We think that it's really solid ground under us, and if it quakes a little, we get very, very nervous. We can't imagine things that don't have a solid foundation that aren't anchored. Ships don't go to sea without anchors, and airplanes don't fly, oftentimes without escape devices like parachutes. But God says, where did I anchor the foundations of the universe, since I created it out of nothing, and I created it right out of zero? I created the raw materials, and then I built the universe like a great craftsman built it. To what were its foundations fastened, or who laid its cornerstone? Cornerstone's a big image through the whole Bible. Jesus is the cornerstone, of course. When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. That appears to be an allusion to the angels. It appears to be. The angels are almost always in the Old Testament called sons of God. Bene Elohim means angels. In the New Testament, it can mean people. In the Old Testament, almost always means angels. Man was not created until the sixth day. Man is not mentioned in this discussion from God. God doesn't bring man into this. Man didn't come around until the sixth day when everything else was created. So God's telling us about the first 6 days of creation when man wasn't even there at all. Even Adam didn't know this stuff. Even the first man didn't know all this stuff. But evidently, really early on, the angels were created. Millions and millions of angels and originally none of them fallen. And what did the angels do? Well, they got to watch this creation going on and sing and praise God and marvel at this work that God was doing. That would suggest that the angels were either created on day one or day two of creation week. We really don't know. There's other people think that the angels came along on the fourth day when the sun, moon, and stars were created. But the idea here in Job is that angels are observers to all this. Well, have you ever seen the angels before? The room full of angels here around here, and you can't see them at all. And there's thousands and thousands, 10,000 times 10,000 of them. Well, the angels are there. And when the angels were there, they sang together. Great heavenly choir. See, that choir comes up again in Revelation again and around the throne of God. Who shut in the sea with doors? That's beautiful imagery there. When it burst forth and issued from the womb, there's an image of childbirth. It's like we've got the earth created and now we've got this great, restless sea. Two-thirds of the earth is covered with water, and the water oceans are far deeper than the land. There's more than enough water in the oceans to cover the whole land if you just leveled the land out a little bit. We'd have, if you leveled all the continents out, you'd have a mile of water all over everything. That's, of course, probably what happened at the time of the Great Flood, was mostly this readjustment of the land masses. There's this beautiful image of the waters of the oceans coming forth, and they have to be contained. There's such an immense amount of water, it's got to be walled in and contained. And who did that? You know what? Tsunamis. We occasionally have tsunamis from an earthquake, and a great tidal wave will sweep over whole islands. Wasn't it 250,000 people died in the tsunami last year? And you hear there's a earthquake zone off of Seattle that's supposed to, if it ever goes, it'll be a super tsunami. It'll just sweep out Oregon and Washington. And we always have, of course, the earthquake that's going to move L.A. out into the break, split L.A. off as a separate continent. And people up here think that's great. Then we get our water back and so on. And that's worthless land down there anyway. And that's Northern California arrogance here. The world as it now is a fallen world. The world as it now is damaged. So we have to be a little careful here. We're talking about a pristine creation that's not damaged as we go on here. Okay. Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band. That beautiful image. This beautiful image of an earth now with a continent and with an ocean. And now God puts this cloud canopy to shield from the heat of the sun. And he separates night from day so that the planet, as it turns on its axis, goes through cycles of night and day. And every single night it gets dark and you go to bed and you sleep. And that's been going on ever since the very beginning, the night and day and with absolute precision and constant rate down through the centuries. Who did that? Who put 7 days in the week and made Sunday a special day? Who did that? When I fixed my limit for it, the oceans and the sea, and set bars and doors. It's the ocean is this great surging reservoir of water, and you've got to, it's as if it has to be behind double doors to make sure it doesn't break loose. That's the way the restless sea is. You read about ships that come into giant waves in the ocean, and giant super waves are rare, but when a super wave comes along, it will wreak havoc on the biggest of ocean liners and freighters, monstrous waves. And the ocean is just a seething, restless body of water. And God says here, no, I put definite boundaries on the oceans, absolute definite bounds. I've walled it in, and you guys are safe. Thus far you may come, but no further. Your proud waves must stop. It's God controlling the ocean. Now then, the next question is to Job. Have you commanded the morning since your days began, and caused the dawn to know its place. What do you know about the wonderful daily experience of sunrise? Do you ever get up and go look at the sunrise? In the Middle East, they would. Do you ever go in the mountains or in the desert or at the ocean and marvel at the sunrise? Absolutely. This incredible way that it gets just a little bit light, and then gradually more light comes in, and now he catches the imagery of what the dawn is like. That dawn takes hold of the ends of the earth. The dawn creeps in on us, and we get more and more light, and it's the kind of light, he says, that the wicked might be shaken out of it. He immediately switches from sunlight to moral light. He switches to spiritual light, driving away the darkness of evil. Because evil deeds go on at night, and all the denizens of darkness go hide in their caves when the sun comes up. That's the idea here. He's all sorts of little creatures that can't stand the light slink back into their holes when the sun comes up. Shaking the wicked. Yes, it's very much the idea that it's a fresh new day. And of course, in a lot of the world, people take their sheets and blankets out and air them out and over the balcony just so you'd get a fresh new change of linen, essentially. Now he says, have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it may take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked shaken out of it? The dawn takes on form like clay under a sea and under a seal and stands out like a garment. When the sun first begins to come up in the morning and you look at the landscape, you only see things dimly. You don't see the detailed features. The more the sun comes up, the more features emerge. Like you see maybe a piece of clay, but then later on, as the light's stronger, you see that there's an impression in the clay. Well, that's the way the dawn is it? We don't see things very well at first. And, of course, morally, that's what now we see through a glass. Now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. So we don't see our dark world very well. But when the Son of Righteousness arises with healing in his wings, then we'll have the light. We'll have full light morally, just like the coming up of the sunrise. So we always have this image in the Bible of Jesus as the greater sunrise. All right. And then... from the wicked, their light is withheld, and the upraised arm is broken. That with the coming of light is this banishment of evil. And the upraised arm, the rebellion against God, is put down. So that's got this double imagery of nature, but also behind it is the God of light, who is the moral judge of all of mankind and will deal with the wicked. All right? What do you know about this, Job? What do you know about all this stuff? It's nothing to me. I can create a universe anytime I want to. Didn't need to create it. I enjoyed creating it. I love the creation. I created the universe with you in mind, but you're not the whole deal. A lot of things I love that just in the creation itself that suggests that maybe a little more care for the environment, maybe a little more. Let's be careful not chop all the trees down and pollute all the waters, and it's not our water anyway, and it's not our fish. And well, I'm rant. Verse 16, have you entered the springs of the sea? Isn't that insightful? What have we discovered in the last few years about the oceans? Way down in the deepest parts of the oceans, there are enormous hot springs with the water temperature under pressure coming out hotter than molten lead. And laden with minerals, and now we know that an awful lot of the minerals in the earth are deposited by subterranean, extremely hot water under great pressure. And you've seen these, they're called smokers, that are columns and deposits of metal in the deep ocean. If you get your submersible too close to them, you'll burn out the plexiglass windows and kill the aquanauts that are in them. Well, did we know anything about the springs in the deep sea until a few years ago? No. Now we still don't know very much about the deep sea, but there it is. Have you walked in search of the depths? How about doing a little walk on the sea floor? You know, a skin diver goes down 100 or 200 feet and thinks he's gone a long ways down. Yes, it is. It's by far, it's more difficult to go to the depths of the ocean. The Mariana Trench is how deep? Is it 13,000 or 17,000? 29,000. And there has been a submersible go down there where the pressure is enormous. That's good. Good word. Well, God's saying, look, that the ocean floor is nothing to me. I've walked around the ocean floor. I'd like to see these National Geographic movies of the deep submersibles and the little creatures that live down there, the strange, luminous little creatures and strange kind of fish and the iridescent creatures that have lights on them. And it's just surreal. It's surreal. And God did all that. And we just get little glimpses down at Monterey, the Monterey Aquarium, does a lot of this stuff from the deep ocean. Just incredible. Well, God walks around on the bottom of the ocean to inspect things. Have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Now, that's an allusion to the underworld, to the Hebrews, Sheol, the grave, to the Greeks, Hades, the underworld. You remember all the mythology that the Greeks had about the underworld and the gods of the underworld and the river Styx and getting in a boat and all of the mythology about the underworld and all of the legends, H.G. Wells' Journey to the Center of the Earth. What do you know about the afterlife? What do you know about the underworld? What do you know about deep mines and deep caverns and about death? What do you know about that? Well, that's just full of mystery to us. It's just we know so little. Even with the New Testament, we really don't know very much, do we? Wow. I think Job must be a little overwhelmed, having a hard time taking notes now. Except he probably has a nice Macintosh laptop, one that records speech, and he's taking notes frantically here. No, I don't think so. Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? Let's switch to geography now. Job, here you live in what's now the land of Jordan. Where else have you traveled? Have you traveled to South America or Australia or New Zealand? Have you been to India? Have you been to the New World? Let's talk a little bit about geography, can we? And about the climate zones of the world. Here you are, this little farm in southern Jordan in the Middle East. Tell me if you know all this. Let's do a little geography lesson. I took freshman geography once a long time ago. Loved it. It was great. Didn't know anything about it. Still don't. But I sure enjoyed the class. Nice. It was really neat. I learned about climate zones and all sorts of nice things. And we had to learn the names of states and state capitals. And we had to be able to fill a map in with the names of nations. And couldn't do it now. But verse 19. Where is the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place? Now, this is really quite profound. God is light. God himself is light. He's spiritual light. And the New Testament suggests that God dwells in unapproachable light, that God is so bright that if you were to get a look at his face, you'd be burned into a crisp right away. And the New Testament says no man can see God at any time. The only begotten Son of the Father, he has made him known. So if we were filled with the light from God right now, we'd be overwhelmed with that brightness. So in order for us to have a universe, God had to wrap himself in clouds. And then he had to create photons of physical light so that we could see and move in our creation. And we have spiritual light in our lives, which is the light of the world, light of Jesus in our hearts. But we just get a little dim glimpse of that great light. The Orthodox churches in the East like very much the image of God as light and the Son of God as light. And that's in their icons and their thinking. And I suppose that's in Thomas Kincaid, I guess, maybe that light. But you see that God himself is light. And yet our world is full of shadows, and it's full of darkness, and it's full of graduations of light, and we have some moral light, but not a lot. So both physical light and moral light are in mind here. Where is the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Can you parcel out light? Do you know how to take light out of a light reservoir and pour it into a cup and give it to somebody? Well, No, probably not. Do you know it because you were born then? Were you born then? How old are you, Job? The number of your days is great. I see you're an old man now. You must be 60, 70 years old. Golly, you've been around a long, long time, God says to Job. How long has God been around? Well, a few thousand years in earth history, but before that, the Ancient of Days, Elyon, God Most High, El Olam, the God of eternity, the God who's outside of time, the God who's existed forever, who encompasses all time and all space and all dimensions. When were you born, Job? You can tell that to your grandchildren when they get stubborn and argumentative. When you've been around as long as I have, you won't talk like that. Your grandfather used to say such and such. We accuse the younger generation of being impetuous and stupid, and they sometimes are, but then so are we. So that's really something. Were you around then? What was it like back in 1910? I wonder, what was it like in the Civil War? Well, we have all the history. You know, history's never very well written. You get everybody's opinion about history, but we got to wait till we get to heaven to go to the library and check out and see what the history really was and get God's view of things. Right now, we just don't see history hardly at all well. Remember what God says to Solomon. God has put eternity into the hearts of men, yet so that man cannot figure out what God has done from the beginning to the end. It is not given to you to know the times and the seasons which the Father has fixed by His own authority. I'm not telling you guys everything about either the past or the future. I'm leaving you in the dark about a great number of things. Of course, you couldn't handle them if I told you. Obviously, Job, you haven't got any questions right so far. And we're only started on our discussion. Have you entered the treasury of snow, or have you seen the treasury of hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? It's like God's saying, it's like God's the thunder God. It's like the God who sends lightning out on his enemies, the way that Roman and Greek mythology would have it, that God rolls boulders around in heaven. But it's like He has a big warehouse full of snow, and He dispenses snow, and He gives an awful lot of snow on the East Coast, and occasionally a little, every 20 years, a little snow here. And He's the one that has hail. So if He gets mad at the people in Texas, He gives them 50 pounds hailstones and smashes their windshields and runs up their car insurance. But that's in a fallen world. That's in a fallen world. By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth? Oh, God's got to manage the weather. And the climates, and the winds, and global warming and global cooling. You know, you get all this evidence that of global warming, and then last night I watched a program on global cooling. And what would happen if the temperature dropped suddenly, and instead of 5 days without power, you had weeks without power, and how you burn up the furniture, and you can't buy wood, and you can't get out of your house, and what a terrible disaster it would be. And these things happen all the time in history, and it's just one of those scare you to death movies. Maybe get you to pray a little bit more. But who's in charge of the weather in a fallen world? Who has divided a channel for the flowing, overflowing of water? Who controls the rivers and the streams and the rainfall and the whole process of water evaporating from the ocean, salt water evaporating from the ocean and going up into the upper atmosphere? And who makes raindrops? In order to make a raindrop, you have to take a little bit of dust and a little particle of dust that water can condense on it, and then water falls down as rain. And if there's an updraft, the raindrop will be carried back up into the freezing zone, and it'll get frozen, and it'll fall again and rise again and get another layer of ice on it. And that's where hailstones are made, by this whole process of what started as dust turning into rain or into hail or into snow. Do you manage, any of you manage that with your home computer? I don't think so. Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolt? Enormous amount of energy in lightning and thunderbolts. I wish we had some lightning storms here just to scare people a little bit, because it's just an awesome display and Arizona and Florida and the Midwest. As a kid growing up in Idaho, we had those. Just wonderful. Just absolutely wonderful. If you don't, you want to not get struck by lightning. The odds of being killed in an airplane crash are about the same as the odds of being struck by lightning. I think that's the current. It's pretty safe to fly, in other words. Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water or a path for the thunderbolt to cause it to rain on a land where there is no one? A wilderness in which there is no man. Now, this is really interesting. There's all kinds of places in the desert or in the jungle where no man has ever been, and yet God lets it rain there, and he grows flowers there, and he sustains animals out there. And for why? Because he likes flowers, because he enjoys deserts, because he likes the creation. It doesn't matter. It's quite irrelevant as to whether a human being ever goes there. That the flowers aren't for our benefit. That those remote parts of the world that are uninhabited are for God's own pleasure and enjoyment. So Palo Alto is for God's own pleasure and enjoyment, but we better be careful about messing it up too much. See the idea here. We'll quit in a second here. God causes it to rain out in desolate places to satisfy the desolate waste, to cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass. Has the rain a father, or who has forgotten the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven? Who gives it birth? The waters hardened like stone, ice and frozen glaciers. The surface of the deep is frozen. In Jordan, Job would have not seen these things in the climate. He would have never been to the Antarctic or the Arctic. And originally, before the flood, these great temperature extremes were probably not known. And here God saying, these are old, familiar things to me. I'm regulating them. The water is hardened like stone. The surface of the deep is frozen. Great areas of the ocean are frozen, even though they're salt water. Well, we'll do a little tiny bit more here. Can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring out Nazareth in its season? Or can you guide the great bear with its cubs? You know the ordinances of the heavens. Can you set their dominion over the earth? Suddenly, God switches up to the constellation, and here he is, 4,000 years ago, telling us that the Pleiades, the seven sisters, was in the sky then, as it is now. You can all go out and find the seven sisters. And the belt of Orion in the winter, Orion comes up in this area, but you've got to get out of the city lights to see it. And the great bear, the big bear, the great dipper, and the Maseroth in its season. He's talking about the constellations. He's talking about astrology here. What influence do the planets have upon the earth? Well, our modern astrology is Babylonian and it's corrupt, but there's a suggestion here that there originally was a gospel in the stars. Just a suggestion. Can't bank on that, but there's order in the whole heavens. And here we are on one little tiny, puny little planet. And not only are we it's just one local star, but there are collections of stars that reach out almost forever. Can you handle that? Nope. I'll shut up there. And after our reading next week, we'll just pick up the text here. Any last minute thoughts, questions, answers to any of these questions? Okay, Steve. Global warming. It's the jury's out. That's a big. I don't think I have a clear opinion on global warming right now, and how and what to what extent it's caused by CO2 emissions from human activity and whatever what's natural. I don't know. That's the question. How much as human. Are human beings responsible for global warming? Is global warming really happening? Or is this just a little cycle that we're going through? I don't know. There's an awful lot of hype about global warming and a lot of political stuff. And there are weather patterns. If you dig an ice core from the glaciers in Greenland from a couple miles up, they'll tell you there's 100,000 years of human history there. Well, there's not. There's maybe 5,000 years of human history in the ice cores, but they're all misinterpreted. an awful lot of CO2 and sulfur comes into the upper atmosphere from volcanoes, Krakatoa, and I forget the names of them. Anyway, and Mount St. Helens lowered the world's temperature by a fraction of a degree all over the whole world, and the sunsets from Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines gave us those pink sunsets for a long time. I was in the Philippines when Pinatubo was erupting. Very impressive. Very worthwhile to go see that. That's a fallen world, too, by the way. That's not the original creation. But we got to quit. End of questions. And Steve will pray.